WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Welcome to WrestleSpective. I'm Jason Mann, and this show is brought to you by our sponsors, RotoReels.com, which is a great place to go to get downloads and DVDs of professional wrestling from the U.S., from Japan, Mexico, pretty much anywhere in which there's professional wrestling, they've got it. And our other sponsor is InternationalObject.com, which is a great place to go for essays on professional wrestling and the liberal arts. Also includes a podcast hosted by good friend K. Sawyer Paul and Rich Thomas. So if you want thoughtful conversation about wrestling, check out internationalobject.com. And my guest today, returning to the show, I think at this point you're a friend of the show, Will.
Ooh, that makes me feel special.
There you go. It's Will Pruitt of ProWrestling.net. Welcome again.
Hey, am I a friend of the show because I'm doing this while I didn't originally call dibs on the match? Is that...
That helps, yeah. You're a fill-in. You know, my first guest who was supposed to do this kind of flaked out. So you are the substitute, and you're way better than anyone else could have been doing this match, I would
say. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm psyched about that.
So we're going to talk about the Royal Rumble 2001 match, which is very... Well, they're all interesting. Every Rumble has sort of some interesting moments in it as well. This is... I think most interesting because, you know, this is about as big as WWE ever got in this era. I mean, we're pretty much at the apex of them as far as, you know, the level of talent they had, their business success. You know, we're near the strongest, what's considered their peak of their creative era as well. So there's pretty much running on all guns here. And, you know, it's just, of course, interesting to look at them when everything is going right, so to speak.
Yeah, and it's also a really interesting Rumble because it wasn't even a year before they started to fall. And that, you know, they're at the apex, but they're really, I think there were even signs in this Rumble of the fact that they would be on their way down soon. And it's so interesting to step back and look at them and go, WWE went from this height, and even if you and I were to podcast the 2002 Rumble and talk about how they fell between the two and how, you know, things kind of played out throughout that year and how WWE without competition was kind of hurt. And at this point, I mean, it doesn't even feel like WCW exists. Like, I was watching this match and I had to remind myself a few times, WCW also had a pay-per-view this month, which it just doesn't seem like that actually happened.
Yeah, they were about as relevant as TNA is usually, you know, unless TNA is having like a strong thing going on. I mean, for the most part, they're not really relevant among most WWE fans. And this kind of felt like basically the same way with WCW, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. They just didn't feel all that relevant. You know, this was post-Radicals jump, post, you know... Everyone who you kind of wanted to see from WCW had already moved on to WWE, aside from what Rey Mysterio was the only guy still there that you were like, that would be cool. And obviously Mysterio's had quite the WWE career since then.
Sure. Yeah. You know, I mean, obviously there's Booker T, there's Scott Steiner, there's, you know, a couple guys like DDP, but they were sort of like, you know, I mean, they had their moments all in WWE, but they were sort of a less exciting group, certainly. I mean, the guys who really had a lot of mileage left, you know, were pretty much already had moved on.
Yeah, that's and you had some real wrestling talent in the company at this moment. They and the I think the variety of styles, which we can get into as we actually talk about the match, was really interesting. The guys, like, you know, you had your hardcore style, which was at its height in WWE. You had, you know, guys like the Radicals who were putting on great technical matches. And then you had the WWE main event style with the wrestlers who kind of made that into a more, I want to say a more fleshed out match, where the Hulk Hogan match was kind of the original WWE main event style. You had guys like Austin and Rock now making that into a really entertaining spectacle of a match beyond just what Hulk Hogan did, and showing their ability to morph and shift as wrestlers depending on their opponents.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was probably a heavier brawling style. And more of like kind of an all out intense physical style. A lot of, you know, a lot of weapons, a lot of table stuff, you know, kind of obviously the ECW influence was there too. And a lot of different things. I mean, obviously I think Austin and Foley to a certain extent were probably the two guys who were the biggest key in the development of that style.
Yeah, absolutely. And Austin in this match, you know, work that style a bit. And it's interesting also when you just look at Steve Austin's career to note that Austin probably started, you know, more than probably, he started wrestling that style because he couldn't do the technical style anymore after he broke his neck. And it's interesting just to see the way that Austin evolved as a performer with those limitations and became, you know, one of the biggest acts in the history of the industry.
Right, right. So let's get into the match. There's a video package beforehand, clips of everyone involved with some dramatic music. The guys they really feature as favorites are, of course, Stone Cold Steve Austin, The Rock, Kane and The Undertaker. There's a whole "Are the Kane and Undertaker Working Together" thread that they had revived at this point, because they had a feud again in, I think, summer of 2000, because they wrestled at SummerSlam, I'm pretty sure. And then kind of after that, Kane did like a random turn on Undertaker, and then they, you know, they had their thing. But then they were patching things up, and they were back together at this point, Brothers of Destruction and all that. But the other guy that they really push heavily here is Rikishi.
Mm-hmm.
And they had, of course, the big storyline in fall of 2000, Stone Cold Steve Austin comes back after his year-long absence with his neck injury. The storyline reason for putting him out was somebody hit him with the car, so the mystery is who did it. And the one thing they discover, it's a blonde guy, and there's, you know, suspects include at this point Billy Gunn and Chris Jericho, and it ends up being, they end up revealing that's Rikishi who did it. I guess the reason for it was because he wanted The Rock to get a chance to shine, and their shared Samoan heritage and so on and so forth. It was kind of that whole thing was pretty weird how they developed that storyline. And then they end up having the Rikishi Austin match. And then we reveal that it's Triple H who is the mastermind behind the whole thing, which also plays into this rumble.
Yeah, Rikishi doing it for The Rock and doing it for the people was definitely strange. And I almost wonder if Triple H was like the Band-Aid that they slapped on. Like, they realized, dude, Rikishi's not going to get over doing this. Okay, well, let's say he had a mastermind and someone in his ear. And, you know, Triple H was the lead heel at this point, so why not make it Triple H? And him and Austin went on to have kind of an uneven feud at Survivor Series, where Triple H, I believe, was put inside of a car, lifted up onto a crane, and dropped down to the pavement. He was on Raw the next night. So, yes. You know, that's like the ultimate no-sell, I'm pretty sure.
It was, yeah. Yeah, I think that the whole development of that feud and the Triple H Kurt Angle feud beforehand that sort of churned Triple H into a de facto face for a little while. I think that's another podcast, but it is worth noting that I think there's a lot of the signs of WWE's creative derailment. Maybe derailment's a strong word, but the that you mentioned there's signs in this match. I think in the fall there were definitely the first visible signs that there was going to be a lot of hurdles to WWE maintaining its creative force and maintaining its, you know, keep everything going the way it was, whether it's politics, whether it's just simply like, you know, staleness or whatever. There was going to be some challenges going forward in that.
Yeah, you even look at the month before this, it was a six-man Hell in a Cell match.
Right.
For the WWE Championship. And I'm all, you know, I love your big spectacle matches and all that. I'm not the wrestling fan who just wants to see two guys in a ring. As entertaining as that can be, sometimes I like a little bit of ladder thrown in. But that match especially, I think you look at and you go, WWE just needed something here. They had gone back to, they were going back to the well at this point, and it was Vince McMahon is the lead heel again. It was, you know, you've got the big spectacle Hell in a Cell with Rikishi taking the big bump off the top of the cell, and they were starting to lose some steam, and I think a lot of people point towards that Kurt Angle and Triple H feud as the beginning of them losing steam. And I think the big rumor is they used to have a writer in that literally would storyboard his storylines, would sit down and go, week to week, this is what we're doing. And the people in creative at the time mocked him for it. And were like, why are we using storyboards? We're wrestling, not a sitcom. And, you know, that writer left, and a lot of his storylines, like Kurt Angle and Triple H, which was very intricate, those stories were left unfinished. And to bring it back to the show, we kind of got the Kurt Angle and Triple H blow off after their summer feud on this show in the co-main event.
Yeah, and both of them being villains in that. So that's kind of an interesting. And that was Chris Kresge was that writer, by the way.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah.
He apparently was also a writer for The Daily Show.
Huh. That I like that.
Yeah, and he unfortunately passed away. I believe it was from cancer. So.
I don't like that.
In 2005, no. But yeah, he. I remember that. And then fall 2000 also is regarded as the time in which Stephanie McMahon was sort of put in charge of creative as well. So there was, you know, there's of course some anti-Stephanie undercurrent in the, you know, in the people who follow wrestling closely. And that's sort of where that was kind of generated in the fall once, you know, she was given control of it. And then the kind of the storytelling sort of changed based on that. And, you know, and how much of that is just perception, how much of that is really what went on, you know, who knows. But
well, I think more of what changed the storytelling when Russo and Ferrara left, Vince McMahon didn't want to just have the team be him sitting at his kitchen table with three or four guys pounding out shows. That's when they moved to the more corporate creative structure that they have now, where it's a larger team of writers, so they're not dependent on one or two people the way that they were on Russo and Ferrara at the time, because those guys were doing way more work than they should have done. So I think what happened is they put Stephanie in charge of it, and at the same time, and this is, I don't think this is Stephanie's fault or anything, but at the same time, they shifted to a more creative by committee approach than one or two people designing and laying things out. And that has ramifications to this day, where we see storylines start and stop and just some strange, not quite right things happen that I think can easily be blamed on this creative structure.
Right, exactly. So, we basically have five favorites, you know, so to speak, which is probably a little bit of a longer version than you normally would get, or a larger number of people than you would normally get as pushed as favorites.
Yeah.
I would say. Yeah. So number one is Jeff Hardy, who gets a loud reaction from the crowd because he's Jeff Hardy and people like him. And number two is Bull Buchanan, who does not.
Bull Buchanan is a part of Right to Censor.
Yes.
At the moment. He is not wearing a tie in the match. And this match reminded me just how much I hated Right to Censor's theme music.
Yeah. Because it was like a loud, it wasn't like a siren, but it was, what was it like?
Kind of a, I feel like siren is the best way to describe it, but it's not quite.
Yeah.
Just how bad it was.
More like a car alarm, actually.
Yeah. They came out to a car alarm. Oh, yeah, because it said, like, warning in the background. So it's like a fancy car when you step too close to it that goes, like, please step away from the Lexus. It was kind of like that kind of car alarm.
Yes. It was, now Right to Censor was their parody of the PTC, was Parents Television Council, I believe.
Yes.
Where they were, protesting WWE programming and decrying all the sex and violent content in it. But they were actually, like, manipulating information and basically putting out lies about WWE's product as well. I mean, they went, like, really crazy overboard with that content. I think they even were forced to apologize to WWE. I think there was a lawsuit involved and a whole lot of shenanigans. It's one of the few lawsuits that WWE's actually won.
Yeah, and there were plenty of things that a group like the Parents Television Council could have complained about WWE for at this time. And, so it's not like they would have had a difficult time finding the right things, but instead they decided to tell lies about WWE, which was really strange because, even in this match, I have in my notes later, Terry comes out and, like, the entire time she's at ringside, it's just a series of nipple jokes. Like, it is, like, from the time she walks through the curtain to the time she goes to the back, all the king basically says is nipple. So it's, there were plenty of things where you could be like, I don't think kids should watch that, and here's why. But the things that they said stretched the truth just a little too much.
Yeah, so they're basically horrible people, so... and of course the lack of necktie indicates to Jim Ross that Bull is very serious about this match.
So, which is strange because normally when I'm serious about something, I wear a tie.
That's very interesting. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I would do the same. Like a job interview, I would wear a tie. I'm being serious.
Yeah, Bull Cannon has his priorities in the wrong places.
Apparently.
Yeah.
So, Jeff attacks him right away, but Bull manages to overpower him a bit, being the bigger man. He flips Jeff over the ropes, but he can't eliminate him. Then Jeff jumps over him off the ropes, follows with a head scissors. There's a big clothesline by Bull. He presses Jeff, but Jeff is able to slip out. Then they brawl in the corner and try to lift each other out. The crowd is not particularly reactive to this, but they do react quite loudly when number three, Matt Hardy, comes out.
Yeah, that was a strange thing, and I think some of it comes from, we talked about the five favorites, and a lot of times the WWE tries to put a favorite in that number one or number two slot, A, to have them fight adversity, and B, I think to keep the crowd invested in the match all the way through the match, and that's something that didn't happen here with Jeff Hardy and Bull Buchanan, is the crowd knew, we can yell and scream for them all we want, we love the Hardys, but... they aren't going to win. They are not going to main event WrestleMania 17.
Right, right. So he attacks Bull. Then he jumps off of Jeff's back into Bull on the corner. Then they double clothesline him out. So now it's our Matt versus Jeff matchup. They touch hands. Jeff gets a waist lock. Matt backs him off into the corner. Then Matt later gets a back suplex. Jeff is able to get a jawbreaker. And I'm surprised because the crowd is still kind of quiet here, even though you would think the Hardy versus Hardy's deal would kind of, be a little bit exciting. And then Jeff is almost able to get Matt over, but Matt hooks the ropes. And then once the countdown begins, they stop fighting and wait for the next man.
Yeah, this was a precursor to the Matt Hardy versus Jeff Hardy feud at the end of 2001 that would last about a month.
Yeah, that was quickly dropped, and then they were like best pals again, as if no one had remembered that. I think that was at the Royal Rumble 02, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they, Matt and Jeff, interestingly enough, the crowd didn't react to their actual feud either. So I think the crowd just didn't want to see Matt and Jeff Hardy fight.
I guess. Yeah. Which, I actually thought their feud was pretty good. I mean, it wasn't, there were a few issues with it, but it was maybe rushed, but, they had some good stuff in it, but maybe you're right. Maybe just one of those things where they didn't want to see him fight. So Farouk is our next man, and he double clotheslines both the Hardys down, but the Hardys are able to counter with a twist of fate swanton, and then they dump Farouk over the ropes. And, Matt then tries to toss Jeff, showing that he, his later, his later deception that he would perpetrate upon Jeff 8 years later. Both of them get topless, and prompting
that was all such a weird sequence. Like, oh yeah, we're gonna take our shirts off. It's on.
Yes, yes. Lawler prompting the Lawler line: are they going to fight or just undress? They shove and punch each other for a bit, and then Jeff gets a moonsault right as the count goes down. And that leads to our number five man, Drew Carey.
Hall of Famer.
Yes, he is a Hall of Famer. And I will point out that Drew Carey is about in the same shape here as Dusty Rhodes was in 1990. So
he was a little more covered up than Dusty, though.
That's true.
As it would have been if Drew Carey had come out in the polka dots.
Yeah, that would have been good. And JR describes him as one of the biggest stars in all of Hollywood.
That might be a bit of a stretch.
It might be a little bit of one, yes. Meanwhile, as Drew is trying to get to the ring, and he takes a while, Matt hits a leg drop off the top. Then Jeff and Matt both end up fighting on top of the corners. And right as Drew comes in, they both fall off the top rope onto the ground. So Drew is the only one in. And so he sort of dances around, gets cocky, waits for the countdown. And then Kane is next, and Drew is not very happy about this.
Does Drew Carey get credited with at least one of the Hardy's eliminations?
He didn't touch them, so I wouldn't say that he would.
I would almost, but he was the last guy in the ring. I mean, you know, kind of the butterfly effect kind of thing. If he had never come out, would the Hardys have been eliminated then?
That's for the statisticians to keep. I can't say for sure.
Who keeps the official wrestling stats?
I don't know. You know, I know Mookie Ghana. I know he's the he does them unofficially. I don't know about officially. So yes, we have Kane next, and Drew, he screams at the referees for some help. Wants the Hardys to come back in because he doesn't want to be alone with Kane. Kane stalks around the ring for a while. Then he does his hand gesturing with the making the fire come up along the ring post. Drew offers a handshake, and Kane refuses. Then he offers Kane a little bit of money, and prompting some good laughs from the crowd. The countdown happens. Number seven is Raven. Kane refuses, backs Drew up. And lifts Drew up for the choke slam, but then Raven grabs a Singapore cane and hits Kane from behind. Kane's Kane. And then Drew hops over the ropes and jumps off the apron and eliminates himself.
Does it seem weird to you at all that Drew Carey brought money to him down to the ring? Like that, you know, as he's putting on his Adidas tracksuit and he's prepping for the match, that he's like, I might need this wad of $10,000. Got to keep it with me.
Well, it's probably just spare change that he keeps in his tracksuit, you know?
That's true. Drew Carey is one of the biggest stars in all of Hollywood, after all.
Yeah.
The Raven sequence was interesting to me because it was the first time we saw a weapon in this match, and it kind of started a run that we would see for the next few guys, that this is when they really brought in the hardcore style of the match. And kind of, I think one of the most noticeable and memorable things about this Rumble was this, you know, 4, 5, 6 guy sequence of hardcore.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, this is kind of the peak of WWE really having its, you know, hardcore division. You know, having a lot of guys who exclusively worked those matches pretty much, you know, of course, Crash Holly and the 24/7 rule and so on and so forth. And they'd spend about another year and a half doing that before they kind of realized, like, hey, all this violence and mayhem for comedy's sake is sort of hurting our ability to tell stories using violence and mayhem in our important things.
Yeah, and that was one of the biggest downfalls of that hardcore style was, when then in a main event, when someone broke out the chair, or the trash can, or the cane, you went, oh yeah, but I saw that earlier in the show and laughed about it. Sure. It really, you know, it downplayed what would become really important storytelling devices.
Sure, sure. Although in this match, yeah, it was probably limited enough where it wasn't like a problem, a singular problem on this show. Plus, this is the main event anyway, so, you know.
Yeah.
But, Kane works Raven over, hits his slide slam. Raven goes outside, uses a fire extinguisher. Lawler makes a quip about how Kane could have used the fire extinguisher at different times in his life, which I thought
I liked that.
Yeah. we get some trash cans tossed in, and suddenly Al Snow runs out, attacks Raven, and tosses him into a barricade. Apparently, we're in the midst of a Raven-Al Snow feud, and Snow had been out for a month or so after Raven had attacked him. Raven hadn't been in WWE for that long. He debuted, I think, October pay-per-view or September pay-per-view in 2000. He interfered in the Jerry Lawler Taz match, costing Lawler the match, I believe.
Now, tell me, do you know if Raven was also working for ECW at the same time?
No, I don't believe so. I believe he was done with that and then came into WWF. I don't think there was ever a crossover.
Okay. Because I know he went back there after his WCW run. So
yeah, that was roughly a year. That was like summer 99 through summer 2000.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember him losing a match to Rhino. I think that was like his last ECW match or his last one on TV anyway. Because they were putting Rhino over all of the old guys like Sandman and probably Dreamer, you know, or almost everyone anyway. Anyone who was leaving, and almost everyone was leaving, of course, at that point. So officially the countdown happens with it's Al Snow. He got out there early, but he was the next guy. Nails them both to trash can lids. Then he grabs a bowling ball out of the bowling ball case and grabs the ball and then rolls it into Raven's crotch. JR makes a unfortunate, given later events, hurricane reference with all the trash that's strewed in the ring. Given that we're in New Orleans, not the best reference to make, of course, you know. Not that he knew Hurricane Katrina would be happening 5.5 years later. So
that'd be weird if JR did know that.
Yeah.
It'd be kind of actually a D-bag move to know that and not to be like, hey, guys, maybe build up them levees.
Yeah.
All right.
So then we get a double drop toe hold into the can. So face first into the can. Saturn comes out. He has Terry Runnels with him.
And rather. She has nipples.
She does. And we get a lot of jokes about that, as you mentioned. He grabs Kane and works it over using a leg submission for a while. Eventually, Kane fends it off. Raven tries a sleeper on Kane. This is one of about 1,000 times during this match in which he jumps on Kane's back and tries the sleeper and gets tossed off. Then Kane boots Saturn, hits him with a press slam. Then Al Snow tries the sleeper on Kane and is tossed down. Then Raven tries it again, and Al Snow hits him with a road sign. Snow and Saturn boot him down while Raven has a sleeper. So a lot of that going on during this 2 minutes.
Yeah, a lot of that abuse was just to make Kane look like a monster. He's hard to take down. He's even when you do get him down, he gets right back up. This whole sequence was kind of Kane getting pummeled with weapons and then, you know, ending up standing again.
Right, right. And we have that again with number 10 Steve Blackman coming out. Hits Raven with some kendo sticks, then also to Al Snow. Hits a back suplex on Saturn, also using the stick for additional force on the neck. Then Kane beats him up for a bit. Saturn goes after Kane's knees some more. Then Snow gets a fancy spin kick on Raven, and we have some more random weapons shots.
And the most important part of this is Jim Ross references head cheese with Al Snow and Steve Blackman in the same ring.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Head cheese.
Head cheese.
Head cheese that was one of my least favorite things to ever happen in WWE.
So it's okay. Let's play a little game here.
Okay.
Head cheese or Shane McMahon as a wrestler?
All right, head cheese, but, you know, that's...
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I'm going to keep defending Shane every chance I get.
Okay.
Someday we may actually need to do a podcast on a Shane McMahon match. That could be interesting. Was he in any, aside from like Survivor Series 01, was he in any actual main events?
Oh, no, we do. We have Vince and Shane McMahon against Steve Austin.
King of the Ring 99.
Yeah, and King of the Ring 2000, too. We have the six-man. Shane's in there as well. So Shane has three.
We should do King of the Ring 99 sometime.
All right.
We could really get into that briefcase.
That's a very important mystery. I bet we can solve it.
I think we could. We should actually go through the whole show looking for clues and trying to put it together.
Yeah.
Do it like Sherlock Holmes style. I'll be your Watson.
Okay, awesome. So next, after our run of hardcore wrestlers, we have Grandmaster Sexay, who I don't believe was long for WWE after this. I feel like he was pretty much going to be gone pretty soon after this, necessitating Scotty Tuhati having a new partner. Because Rikishi had abandoned him, and now Grandmaster was about to.
This was around the time, too. This was one of the last shows. I think this next month's show was actually the last show that, or at least the last pay-per-view that Jerry Lawler called. This was around the time that Jerry Lawler left after they fired Stacy the Cash Carter.
Yeah.
So according to the Wikipedia, Scotty got sidelined in 2001 with a broken ankle. He formed a short-lived tag team with Steve Blackman and then was released for illegally conveying carrying drugs across the U.S. and Canada border.
Oops.
Yeah, that's a bummer for him.
Yeah.
He shouldn't have done that.
No. So Grandmaster Sexay, he grabs a trash can lid, attacks Raven, Saturn, and Snow. He tries to toss Snow out, but it is unsuccessful. Raven again tries a sleeper trick on Kane. Kane grabs a trash can and hits Sexay in the face to knock him over the top rope. There's trash can shots for everyone. He tosses Blackman, but Blackman's able to hold on. But then Kane nails him with the can while he's hanging on the apron to eliminate him. Then he tosses Al Snow. Then he kicks Raven over the top. Then he nails Saturn with a trash can and tosses him. So the ring is cleared of all, I believe, of these six other men in a matter of minutes.
This was Kane's kind of, you know, we talk about Kane getting the elimination record in this match. And it was sequences like this where, you know, he just got to go all monster crazy and eliminate five guys in the span of a minute that gave him that record and that really at least assisted him in getting it. And then later in the match, it just seems like his longevity, you're going to end up throwing out a couple dudes with how long he was in there. So this was kind of the beginning of him getting that record. And it was also to set up the next guy coming out.
Yeah. Number 12, the Honky Tonk Man.
Brilliant.
This is
just
stuff. I believe I saw on Twitter that you were very surprised to have seen the Honky Tonk Man here. You did not remember that he was a part of this Rumble.
I didn't. I don't think I've watched the 2001 Rumble since 2001. So, you know, I remembered who won it, and I remember, you know, the Kane thing gets referenced in so many video packages that it was like, okay, I knew that was going to happen. But to see Honky come out, that was quite the surprise, and it was an exciting one. My favorite thing about Honky's appearance was how happy Jerry Lawler was to see him.
Yes, and singing along. He was singing along to the song.
He was doing the backup.
Yes, because Honky comes, he dances around the ring, he grabs the mic, he's got the guitar with him. He says, hey, everybody, you know, you all want to see me sing and dance, because, of course, obviously the crowd wants to see the Honky Tonk Man sing and dance. So he dances and sings his Honky Tonk Man song, which is wonderful, and Lawler sings along with the chorus, encourages Jim Ross to do the same, but he does not do that. So, unfortunately, Kane ruins things by grabbing the guitar and nailing him on the head, and then throwing him out.
It was one of my favorite things was the way that Honky was holding the guitar, because it was so awkward. Like, he wasn't holding it like he was going to play it. He was just holding it up as he sang his theme music.
Sure.
That was, you know, one of those little things about Honky Tonk Man in this appearance that really entertained me. I thought this was a nice break in the Rumble. I thought that Honky getting eliminated was kind of the end of the first act of this Rumble.
Right.
You know, the first act of the Rumble was all about Kane for the most part. It was about that hardcore style and using the weapons and really, trying to make this first part fly by with, aside from Kane, 11 guys that you knew could not win the Rumble. There was, you know, you look at the first 11 guys out and you take Kane out of there, or you look at the first 12 guys out and you take Kane out, and Farouk, Steve Blackman, Saturn, Bull Buchanan. I mean, you knew even in 2001, these guys don't have a shot, but they still kept the match itself entertaining.
Yes. Number 13 is The Rock, who is popular.
Very popular.
Yes. He gets a flurry on Kane, a clothesline off the ropes. He tries to toss him over, but Kane clotheslines him down right away. We get a Rocky chant from the crowd. Kane beats him up for a little bit, but Rock punches him back and runs right into a boot. So basically back and forth for a couple of minutes. Number 14 is The Good Father, also a member of Right to Censor. He had reformed his ways as a pimp and was now doing the good work, thus the name change.
Yeah, he did not have hose anymore, which I think made him like at least 75% less popular with Jerry Lawler.
At least, maybe more than that. Yeah. Yeah.
It may have been 100%. I don't know that Jerry Lawler even knew who he was without the hose.
Right. Well, let the statisticians figure out the exact percentage. Rock hammers him right away, his former Nation of Domination partner, not mentioned, not surprisingly, and then punches him over the top very easily, very quickly. So Rock then runs into a Kane punch, and then Kane suplexes him. And then Kane spends a little bit of time choking him on the mat, which JR describes as a carnivore chewing up a piece of Rock Burger.
Would you eat Rock Burger?
I would not eat Rock Burger, no.
I don't think I would either. It does not sound delicious. And Rock actually, if it's an actual physical rock, that's not meat. So a carnivore, while they may eat it for funsies, probably would not enjoy it.
No. So that was very colorful metaphor on JR's part.
Yeah, this was also, we should mention, commentary-wise, this run and this time was kind of the height of Jim Ross as a great color commentator, or great play-by-play commentator.
Yeah.
And he got worse as time went on, because I don't believe he did. But with how hot the product was, Jim Ross was just that good. It should also be noted that the Good Father had his tie on.
He did. That's true. So he was either less serious or more serious, depending on how you want to define that.
Yeah, that's and The Rock eliminated him with the spit in the hand and slap, which might be the only time that move has done anything to help Rock win a match.
It's very possible.
Yeah.
I would say that Ross and Lawler, their chemistry, I think, was at a peak here. I mean, if you know, this isn't as memorable of a performance, certainly, as the, let's say, the Heenan Monsoon commentary at Rumble 92. But this is a similar high water mark for Ross and for Lawler here, I would say.
Yeah, they were, just as a commentary team, they meshed really well. And it was before, like I said, it was before Lawler's first absence from the company after Stacy Carter was let go.
Right.
So it was, you could really feel the chemistry there. I thought, I will say too, that I thought a few months later when Paul Heyman came in, that Heyman and Ross became instantly one of my favorite commentary teams and continue to be to this day.
Yeah, they were very good together as well. And it was a different dynamic, but it worked, you know, pretty well. I wish they'd had a better product to call. That'd be the only thing, given the crappiness that the Alliance evolved into pretty quickly. But yes, they did a very good job together.
Yeah. Speaking of just, you know, guys doing a good job together and Ross and Lawler, it should also be noted this was Lawler was not an all-out heel anymore. You know, he still I think he still liked Mr. McMahon a little bit, but him and Ross had become frenzies at this point. It wasn't like the 98-99 level of them bickering and arguing back and forth that made them great.
Right. Yeah, and this was after, because there was the great angle where Taz berates Lawler, or excuse me, berates Ross, and then Jerry Lawler punches Taz, and then you get the big Taz-Lawler feud, the really, really great match at SummerSlam 2000. And which, of course, so that basically meant that Lawler and Ross, you know, had to be friends at that point, since obviously it saved him. Although, Taz is next in the ring, and it's funny because, Lawler's almost sympathetic with Taz here, because Taz basically, he runs in, Kane picks him up, puts him on the top rope, and then punches him out. He's in there for less than 10 seconds.
Yeah, and Taz actually got pyro.
That's true, yeah.
I remember him having pyro in his WWE run, and I saw, you know, the explosion on the entryway, and I was like, Taz? Really? That's okay, WWE. You can be crazy if you want.
Yeah, I mean, Taz, you know, he had a big debut, of course. They mentioned it at the Rumble the year before, but obviously in a year's time, he had... you know, he was basically, you know, very, very low level at this point, and would basically kind of, he would be around for another year in a few months, and then would, you know, become a full-time announcer and basically retire. So, you know, I mean, he did a couple of memorable things, but, you know, people were kind of expecting him to be a big deal when he came in, but obviously with his size and, you know, and maybe with his attitude, that probably really wasn't going to happen.
And I think with the wear and tear on his body as well, after spending so much time in ECW wrestling, that a really difficult hardcore style, because while WWE did a safer hardcore style for theirs, ECW, a lot of that style was about, hey, you're going to go home injured and you're going to have, you know, Taz ended up retiring with neck issues. And we don't know how much that was bothering him in that time.
Sure.
I feel like there was the notable rivalry with Lawler, and then Taz winning the ECW title and losing a match as ECW champion on SmackDown to Triple H. Those are the notable Taz moments in his WWE run, and especially in the year between his debut and this Rumble.
Right. Yeah. I would definitely agree with that. We also have a "My crap is bigger than Taz" sign we can see. So that's very tasteful.
Yeah. That fan. That guy is classy.
He is classy, sure. Indeed. So Kane is hanging on the ropes. Rock lifts him up, and they battle for a bit. Kane gets a face rake, which I don't know if I've seen really Kane use the face rake before, but there's one time at least. And then Rock gets the Samoan drop.
Yeah, I think Kane's face rake. Did he do it with the hand with the glove or the hand without the glove?
I feel like it was with the gloved hand, but I can't remember for sure.
That could be, you know, it could hurt more with the leather glove.
Yeah. Or was he wearing gloves on both hands at this point?
I think he, I have the matchup right now. Right hand was a black leather glove. Left hand was a black arm cuff.
Ah, but, okay. Interesting. So we have number 16 is Bradshaw. We have three WWE champions or past or future WWE champions all in the same ring at this point. And he goes after Kane at first. Rock comes up and they double team for a bit, but then Bradshaw hits Rock with the clothesline from hell, which Rock sells very, very well. Takes a great little, you know, knockdown bump off of that.
Yeah, he doesn't do the full-on flip that some guys used to do for the clothesline from hell, but he definitely did a nice little fall for it.
Yeah. And then a bit later, Rock is able to hit a spine buster on Bradshaw, but then Kane immediately knocks him down, and then Kane boots Bradshaw down, which leads to a number 17, Albert, who has a shirt on, does not get any reaction whatsoever, apparently is still managed by Trish, but is no longer teaming with Test.
Yeah, I guess TNA broke up, and Trish at this point, while she may have been managing Albert, the bigger story she was involved in was with Vince McMahon, Stephanie McMahon, and Triple H, and you know, post their whole, you know, post the whole thing where Stephanie thought something was going on with Triple H and Trish, but now Trish was the mistress of Vince McMahon, who was cheating on the catatonic Linda McMahon.
Right, right. All right, apparently, according to Wikipedia, the team separated after Bloom, or this being Albert, attacked Test under the orders of Stephanie McMahon Helmsley.
Okay.
And then in April 2001, he formed X Factor with Justin Credible and X-Pac.
So this was kind of a, you know, not teamed era for Albert, which was strange, given that he would, I think, at least be paired with another act for most of his first WWE run. Of
yeah.
course, he's only paired with Sakamoto.
Right, right, exactly. The Hip Hop Hippo stuff, that would happen in late 2001, early 2002 with Scotty Too Hotty. So I was a little bit off my timeline with that, but just to correct the record.
Yes.
Also, of course, we have Albert and Kane doing some work in this match, and then Albert and Kane would have the inexplicably great Intercontinental title feud in the fall of spring-summer of 2001.
I can't say that I remember that feud at all.
Oh, they had a couple of really, really randomly great TV matches.
I'm going to have to go back and watch that today or tomorrow. That sounds... I could see that being really good.
Yeah. I even did a podcast, not just about that, but also, like, we did some big man versus big man matches, and that was one of the ones we did. So
nice.
It's good times. So he gets no reaction here. He has a shirt on. He goes after The Rock, but then is double teamed by Kane and Bradshaw for a bit. Then there's some pairing off. Albert is close to getting Bradshaw over, and Kane gets Rock on his shoulders. Albert gets Rock on the ropes, but is clotheslined by Bradshaw, who follows with a big boot. Number 18 is Hardcore Holly. Again, another guy who gets no reaction. I believe it's Jim Ross who has the line. What do you think about Hardcore Holly now? How do I answer that question?
Well, I think in order to answer that question, you have to know what you thought of Hardcore Holly before. So maybe you can talk about how your thoughts have shifted as it concerns Hardcore Holly.
I don't feel like I like Hardcore Holly very much as a performer. He did have sort of the fun late 99, early 2000 thing when he first developed the Hardcore Holly character and was talking big and calling himself the Big Shot and, you know, messing with the Big Show and stuff like that. I feel like that was kind of the highlight, and then that kind of ran its course, and he kept that character for years and years, but it got progressively less and less interesting.
I remember at least at the time enjoying the stuff that he and Crash Holly did with the scales.
Yes.
Yeah, the whole I'm a super heavyweight thing. That was fun, but for the most part, as a performer and from what, you know, we've heard about Hardcore Holly as a person, I'm not a fan.
No, not a huge fan.
He's an angry dude.
He seems a little angry, and I like my dudes happy.
Yeah, me too. I mean, that might be why I like Albert so much. I just see him as a smiley guy.
He does seem like a smiley guy. So Albert hits a double chokeslam bomb on Bradshaw. I'm sure it was a smiley one.
Yeah. Can we just start calling that the smiley bomb?
Okay, we will do that. From now on, it is a smiley bomb. So Holly and Bradshaw later try to get Rock over but are unsuccessful. Albert nails a scissors kick on Kane.
That was a good-looking move.
Yeah, yeah. And Rock clotheslines Bradshaw out of the corner. And Rock, at this point, comes close to eliminating Kane but is unable to do so. Number 19 is Kate Quick, who is the feature R-Truth.
Yeah, and his music hit, and I was like, what is this? Because it sounded like a weird New Age Outlaws theme song remix, and I'm like, is that from that crappy Aggression album WWE made? Oh no, it's the R-Truth and the Road Dogg song, It's About to Get Rowdy.
Yeah.
It got rowdy in there.
It got pretty rowdy. Yeah, that was a short-lived thing. I think Road Dogg got hurt or got fired or something along those lines, and he kind of floundered as a singles guy. And then was one of the first stars of TNA and actually was their second champion, I believe, and kind of their first breakout, relatively new, fresh guy, even though he had, you know, a small WWF run.
Yeah, I actually, Ron Killings did some fun stuff in TNA at certain points. Sometimes it was a little much. There was the time when he challenged John Cena to, like, battle rap him. That was strange. But he also did some really great heel work in TNA around the early years of the company. And he famously won the TNA Tag Team Championships with NFL player Pac-Man Jones.
Sure.
That's worth noting when you're talking about the career of Ron the Truth Killings.
Yeah. So his first Royal Rumble, obviously. He attacks Albert, but that does not go so well. And we have lots of rope draping as people are trying to eliminate things. Rock ends up getting K-Quick on his shoulders, but he fights out. Then Bradshaw powerbombs K-Quick almost simultaneously as Kane power slams Bob Holly.
Yeah, that was a really cool looking sequence. This part of the match was the ring filling up again. We had, you know, the ring filled up and then got emptied by Kane. And then they, you know, Kane and Rock went back and forth for a while, but then they separated Kane and Rock and they started filling the ring again. It, you know, kind of leading you to know that there's going to be another rapid elimination sequence in the near future.
Yes. Number 20 is Val Venus, the leader of Right to Censor, I guess. Wearing a tie.
Val Venus wasn't the leader. He was, wasn't Stevie the leader?
Oh, I guess Stevie was the leader. I guess Val, yeah, that's right. Yeah, Stevie and Ivory, yeah, were in there. I guess, yes, Steven Richards was the leader.
Yeah.
Val was probably the number one, like, wrestler, you know, the centerpiece wrestler of Right to Censor.
Absolutely. And Val Venus also, I just have to wonder, how many other former porn stars have stood up for censorship as bravely as Val Venus did?
Other than maybe, who's the one with Deep Throat who became later a huge anti-porn advocate?
Oh, I have no idea.
Linda Lovelace, maybe?
Yeah, that would be the woman from Deep Throat. So okay. It's like her and Val Venus, they stand together as former porn stars against porn.
I wonder if she's a big libertarian, too.
You know who we could ask about that someday? Kane.
Yeah, in fact,
I assume he knows every libertarian.
Val Venus and Kane goes right after Kane, so I guess their shared libertarianism does not keep them together in this match.
I just feel like now if we saw them in the ring together, one of them would have, like, Ron Paul 2012 across their back or on their body somewhere and have it exposed.
Yeah, yeah. So he gets some knees on Kane, but Kane gets a spine buster. He grabs the tie. Holly, meanwhile, chokes Rock, but is Rock uses an eye rake to fend out of it. So a lot of eye rakes from people who don't normally use them, I feel like, in this match.
I feel like a Rock eye rake was a little more common than a Kane one, though.
You might be right.
Cause Rock, I feel like Rock used the eye rake a lot when he worked as a heel.
Yeah, that's true. He didn't spend that much time. Well, I mean, I guess he did 98, but at this point, you know, he didn't really do, you know, his heel stuff post 99, you know, wasn't extensive. So Bradshaw gets sort of an odd spear on K-Quick. Kane nails Val with a big uppercut, and Rock power slams R-Truth. Then number 21 is William Regal, who is yours and mine and everyone's European champion.
How great was his theme music in this period?
It was pretty good, although I don't think it's quite as good as Real Man's Man, which I will go to my grave defending as a great theme song.
And that's your right. That is absolutely your right. Yeah, but I wondered at this point, someone in the crowd had an air horn, and I just wondered, why is there always the one guy with an air horn at every Royal Rumble? It wasn't like SummerSlam 1992 annoying, or yeah, that was 92 from Wembley with the air horn, but it was pretty obnoxious.
Yeah, the air horn's always a bad thing. It's not quite as bad as the 88 Rumble where the woman has the megaphone, though. which thankfully they take away from her, or she just stops using it at some point during that. But for at least the first 45 minutes or so of that show, there is a loud megaphone of her screaming into it.
45 minutes is a really long time to let that go on.
Maybe not quite 45, but it's a decent amount of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. William Regal kicks Kay Quick and nails him with some uppercuts, also a jumping knee and a cradle suplex. He punches Bradshaw in his corner, of course, being a southpaw with his left hand, which Jim Ross makes a note of. Rock hits Val with the spine buster. Later, we get Val lifting Rock onto the ropes. The crowd is loud every time Rock is even anywhere close to being in jeopardy, even though, obviously, with most of the people who are trying to eliminate him, he's not in real jeopardy. But everyone's playing along, so that's fun. And Rock ends up draping, or Holly ends up draping Rock on the ropes, but Rock hangs on. Number 22 is Test, who I'm surprised also gets no reaction. Now, granted, Test had been in the tag team TNA, and his career had been sort of in a little bit of a downfall over the past year, with that not really clicking and him kind of falling, pretty low on the card after getting, kind of a quasi big push at the end of 99. But yeah, no reaction here.
I almost wonder if fans just don't like, if at this point it was, we don't really like Test, because Test seemed totally chill with being left at the altar. He was like, oh, you're leaving me? I'm going to go be part of this tag team with Albert. I'll see you later. Like that was the Test reaction. And it wasn't until like the end of 2000 when he's like, I kind of don't like you guys, and this is why. So I think just in a way, like, fans stopped respecting Test and found it hard to react to him.
Maybe. I think that's a pretty good theory. He's able to dump Regal, though. Unfortunately, Regal's time in this Rumble is very short. Then he goes after Albert, gets a big boot on Venus, which leads to number 23, The Big Show, who is making his big return after being absent since the summer. He has spent some time in OVW working on his ring work and apparently losing weight, although there was real...
He looked huge.
Yeah, there was really no visual evidence of that. He has a shirt on. He headbutts and clotheslines Test over the ropes. He presses K-Quick over the ropes. Chokeslam for Albert, chokeslam for Bradshaw, chokeslam for Val Venus, then Hardcore Holly, the former Big Shot, then Kane, then he tries a chokeslam on the Rock, but Rock low blows him and clotheslines him right over the top rope. So Big Show does all that, but is out in less than 2 minutes.
Did Big Show end up, I'm trying to remember, did he end up doing anything at a WrestleMania 17 in 2001, or was this kind of a return and then a disappearing act from
no,
him?
No, he was in the hardcore three-way match with Kane and Raven.
Okay, and it was not long after this that Big Show would start impersonating people, giving us the brilliant moment of the Showster.
No, that was that had already happened. That was April 2000.
I fail it when things happened.
That's okay. Nobody's perfect. Yeah, he, I feel like he disappeared for a while during the Alliance period and then came back around Survivor Series 2001.
Okay. I was going to say, I don't remember him being super involved in the, in the invasion and the Alliance situation.
He faced Shane, in the Last Man Standing match at Backlash, and he was and he was also in not the Invasion match itself, but he was in the pay per view. He basically was really just doing like a bunch of like random mid card stuff. Like he wasn't doing anything special. He didn't really get back into main events until a little bit in early 2002, kind of right after the brand split, because he turned on Austin and joined the NWO. And then really heavily, he went over to SmackDown and then sort of was thrown into an instant feud with Brock Lesnar and was sort of put back into main events after randomly losing matches to Jeff Hardy only a few months earlier.
All right.
He was kind of up and down. But mostly down during these couple of years. Crash Holly is next 24, but right as that entrance is happening, which I don't even think the camera ever cuts to, Sho clears the monitors off the table, pulls Rock out of the ring, and then chokeslams him through the table. Meanwhile, everyone in the ring is sort of ganging up on Kane in the corner, although we don't show it too much as we're cutting to Rock being hurt and Sho leaving. And of course, this is sort of a nice play into their 2000 storyline, since Rock was the winner of the Rumble, eliminating Sho, but Sho legitimately complains about the fact that Rock, his feet touched the floor on that, and thus he should have been eliminated first.
Which leads to the WrestleMania 2000 four-way match that is better left undiscussed.
Right.
Yeah, it was odd. Not like, I think Crash Holly had the most anticlimactic entrance in this Rumble.
Yes, it definitely did. Lawler's also without his headset for a bit, so we have Ross talking for the entire time. Kane sort of fends off everyone on their attack, although they definitely, you know, he kicks them off, and then they kind of go after him again. And then number 25 is The Undertaker.
Who keeps rolling.
He does keep rolling, yeah. See, the first version I watched of this, I watched it twice. The first version has his, like, the music, it's dubbed over. It's like his regular theme that he would have through most of like 01 and 02.
The Dead Man Walking theme?
Right. Because he had the, because first he had the American Badass Kid Rock theme.
But he didn't have that for long at all.
No, then he fairly quickly switched to Rollin' by Limp Bizkit. And then eventually they stopped feeling like paying for that and then went for his more generic theme. And none of them were good, but probably the third one was the de facto best, just based on the fact that it was not Limp Bizkit or Kid Rock.
I'm always happy when music is not Limp Bizkit or Kid Rock.
Right.
That makes me happy as a person listening to a wrestling show. But Undertaker came down on the motorcycle.
Yep.
Also, you know, it was the American Badass period, his first Rumble as the American Badass.
Right. Which is amazing that lasted, like, almost 4 years, or 3.5 years, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. He saves Kane from this attack. They give each other a look. Then Undertaker tosses Bradshaw. Kane kills Crash Holly. Kane clotheslines Albert, and Undertaker tosses Bob Holly and Val Venus. And then Kane and Undertaker slowly walk toward each other, and there's a bit of a stare down. So there's a lot of eliminations there. Next, probably my favorite moment of the Royal Rumble is when Scotty Too Hotty walks down to the apron.
Down. He's just so scared.
He's very scared. He's wary, of course. He slowly takes his coat off. He walks into the ring, runs into punches and a big boot by Undertaker, body slammed by Kane, then is double choke slammed by both the men. And I don't sense there's much of a reaction here, because I think the crowd is beating up somebody who the crowd still sort of likes. And then he is tossed over the top rope, eliminated mercifully quickly. And then Rock, you see him slowly recovering at the table still after all of this. And then Kane and Undertaker await the next man, number 27, who is Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Yeah, I would say that the Scotty Too Hotty elimination is the end. You know, like I mentioned to you before we started recording, I tried to figure out kind of the three-act structure of this Rumble. And I would say Scotty Too Hotty getting thrown out was the beginning of the end of Act 2. And Rock moving and Austin's music hitting would be the beginning of Act 3, the kind of final act, the final portion of this Rumble where things got very serious.
Indeed. Indeed. So as Austin is making his way to the ring, Triple H attacks from behind. And they brawl for a while. Triple H tosses him into a rail. This is all revenge for the Austin had attacked Triple H during the Triple H angle, Kurt Angle singles match That was the WWE title match of the pay-per-view. And that was revenge for Triple H costing Austin the title in a Raw Austin angle match in December, I believe, or maybe early January. Regardless, it was a revenge for that attack. And of course, there was revenge for the other things that we described earlier in the show.
And this would actually end up leading to a phenomenal match from Triple H and Steve Austin just 1 month later.
Yes.
At No Way Out 2001. One of the best of both men's careers. There are three stages of hell match at that show.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the as you mentioned, that was a very mixed feud, and the early part of it was pretty bad, and it cut off some more exciting things that it could potentially happen for both men. But it did lead to a great second chapter of the feud and that awesome match.
Yeah. So. Which, interestingly enough, you know, Austin was going to WrestleMania to challenge for the championship. He actually lost that match to Triple H, which I think surprised a lot of people. And what was one of, I feel like that's one of the only times in WWE history that you've gotten a babyface walking out on the losing end of a feud.
You know, of a big feud, yeah.
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 Like a main event babyface losing to a main event heel in the blow off.
Yeah, I would. I can't think of too many other ones that you could say that about. You know, off the top of my head, I'm sure there are, you know, maybe a handful, but yeah, that's certainly the highest profile one. And you know, credit to Austin for being able to pull that off the way they did.
And they told a really, this is getting off track a little bit, but they told a really fun story with Austin going into WrestleMania 2001. A fun story of desperation and the fact that he needed to win that match to prove that he still had it, because he was questioning himself after losing to Triple H. And I think, you know, you look at wrestling today, and I always say that there could be more of that. When a wrestler loses a big match, why not have him question himself? Why not have him wonder, do I still have it? And, you know, make his goal, his objective, to prove that he does.
Yeah, and they sort of did that with Cena after losing to The Rock at the last WrestleMania, but that seemed to have like lasted like 2 weeks, and then it was sort of forgotten about.
Yeah, that was the most disappointing part of that, is that it didn't go on for longer. I thought that John Cena right now could still be questioning himself and trying to redeem himself after that loss to The Rock, and it could really, it could be an important storyline point.
Sure, sure. So Austin is beaten up near the entrance, tossing the equipment and bleeding. Rock, meanwhile, goes back in and goes after Kane. And then number 28 is the one Billy Gunn.
He is no longer an ass man.
He is no longer an ass man. He would, you know, perhaps become one again later, but at this point he is simply the one. And this was sort of a weird in between DX and Billy and Chuck thing for Billy Gunn. They tried it again with him being the good guy. He feuded with Chris Benoit over the Intercontinental title. First he beat Eddie Guerrero, and then he lost it to Chris Benoit. So pretty quickly, and that was kind of his last big push before the Billy and Chuck days.
Yeah, they tried. This was kind of the last big singles push attempt for Billy Gunn, and they tried so many things between 1999 and 2001. You know, he split off from DX before DX got back together as a heel group, and he really, they wanted him to work as Mr. Ass. They gave him the King of the Ring, and they gave him that big feud with The Rock, but it never worked with Billy Gunn. Something about him never clicked. And this, you know, even in this Rumble, he was, I believe, yeah, he was in the final four of the Rumble, but he still, something about him did not click.
Yeah. I think it was just the fact that, you know, he needed a partner to be in a tag team. I mean, he was much better in those circumstances. I mean, every tag team he was in was, you know, much kind of bigger than the sum of its parts, and especially Smoking Guns, and to an extent the Outlaws too. I mean, so I think that was just some guys are just better in a team or in a group or with a partner, and I think he's one of those guys.
And Billy Gunn can say, you know, he was in three really good tag teams. I mean, I enjoyed the Smoking Guns, really enjoyed the Outlaws at the time, even though now when you look back on the act, you're embarrassed to say that. And Billy and Chuck were a very fun tag team act and, you know, kind of had one of, you know, those major SmackDown moments that if WWE weren't PG would probably get replayed much more often.
Sure. So he attacks Kane, gets a bit of offense in. Meanwhile, the refs are trying to get Triple H off of Austin. Kane clotheslines Gunn in the corner. You see Austin being very, very bloody. Rock gets a flurry of punches on Undertaker, and Undertaker lands a DDT. And I don't think I can possibly quite convey how excited Jim Ross is about this DDT.
He said something like, I'm surprised Rock can even still move after that. And it was even kind of a sloppy DDT. Like, it wasn't a crisp Rob Van Dam sells it by landing on his head style DDT. It was just like, that's a little, you know, the Jim Ross hyperbole at this point was a little bit out of control.
Maybe a little bit, yeah. Number 29 is Haku, who just on this show jumped from WCW. He was the WCW hardcore champion, but was apparently working without a contract, so they just sort of snapped him up and put him on this show.
This, of course, you know, is remembered as being as big as the Lex Luger jump in 1995.
Perhaps, but maybe not quite as much, but it was nice to see him. And he had an outstanding afro, gets a big flurry on Kane and Undertaker, both beats them both up for a while. So they certainly sell for him like he's a top guy. And meanwhile, Jim Ross is just really, really angry about Austin being attacked and not getting his chance to be in this Rumble and about everything he's had to overcome and so on and so forth.
Yeah, that was an interesting sequence. I also just wanted to say once during this podcast, Kane and The Undertaker are in cahoots.
They are in cahoots, it appears.
When I think of watching wrestling, I think of Kane and Undertaker being in cahoots. Like that's something that is very memorable to me. But I liked seeing Haku here. It was a fun little surprise for the Rumble. I think one of the only times that number 29 and 30 have both been Samoan.
Probably. I would guess that's very possibly true. So.
Yeah. Or we could even stretch that out to non-European nationality. And I think you would still be able to say that it's the only time.
We'll leave that to the statisticians to figure out. So number 30 is Rikishi, who, much like my attempt at a joke there, got no reaction at all.
I'm sure, you know, I left space there for the listener to laugh, because I think that the listener is really enjoying this ongoing statistician joke.
Yeah.
Well, I think, listener, you're welcome.
He tries to attack Austin on the outside, but Austin suddenly fists of fire, punches back. They both are sent in, he knocks down Billy Gunn. He stomps the proverbial mud hole in the corner. Then he clotheslines Haku over the top. Taker lands a choke slam on Rikishi. He nearly tosses the Rock, but the Rock holds on. Taker headbutts Rikishi, but we're still racist in 2001, falls victim to the hard head, which I figured we were done with that by this point, but apparently not.
And they didn't say, like, Jim Ross didn't say, he has a hard head because he's Samoan.
Right.
He just said, Rikishi has a harder head than The Undertaker. Like, it's like he was trying really hard not to be racist about it, but it still existed. We should also note that Rikishi is a bad man.
He is. He is a bad man. Rikishi super kicks The Undertaker to eliminate him, which the crowd is very surprised by. Rock is able to get a flurry on Rikishi, but Rikishi is able to hit the butt splash in the corner. Rikishi sets up the bonsai drop, but Rock gets a low blow and then knocks him over the ropes. And Rock and Rikishi had sort of had a mini feud after the whole Rikishi attacks Austin thing. In fact, I think they had a Survivor Series match that Rock won to basically end it. But I was surprised that Rikishi had gotten that big heel push and it just, yeah, no reaction just was not clicking. I mean, I didn't remember it being very successful, but it certainly was something that really, really failed pretty dramatically.
It was less successful than you remembered it being, which is really surprising. How soon was it that Rikishi was back to being a good guy at this point?
It actually didn't happen until December, because he and Haku had the Island Boys team for a little bit, and then Rikishi got hurt, made a very brief mini comeback in like May after a month or so. I think he missed WrestleMania, and then he got hurt again, and then was out till December, and then turned face in December.
All right.
He gave Stephanie McMahon a stink face to turn back into a good guy.
That seems like the obvious way to do that.
Yeah. So our final four are The Rock, Kane, Steve Austin, and Billy Gunn. And Kane has been out here for about 50 minutes, which marks one of the few times in the Rumble I can think of a guy getting both the eliminate a lot of guys push and the longevity push.
Yeah, normally you see that given to two separate people, and like I mentioned earlier, Kane had the flurry at first and then just eliminated some random dudes and got a nice little half of a flurry with his brother The Undertaker.
Sure.
It's strange to see that for Kane, and it also, with Kane getting pushed so hard in this Royal Rumble, it's strange to me that Kane was not in a higher profile match than just the hardcore championship match come WrestleMania time.
Sure.
You'd think that after this, he would have been, you know, put in there with a guy that wasn't main eventing the show. But, you know, Kane, I think, was a babyface at this point, that he would have been put in there with a Triple H and not just as an accessory to Undertaker in his feud with Triple H.
Right. But there wasn't, I mean, where's the spot for him is kind of the question.
Yeah.
Because it really isn't necessarily a guy you can work with at that level. I mean, I guess Big Show was kind of, in theory, around that level, but he was just, you know, because he was sort of working his way back or whatever. I mean, you know, I guess in a sense, a Kane-Big Show match might seem like a bigger deal than a three-way hardcore match, even though it has two of the same guys in it. But, you know, that's wrestling.
Yeah.
Gunn lands a few punches on Austin. Austin almost gets the stunner, but Gunn is able to get the famouser. He flips off Austin after that, which is probably a mistake, because as he tries to toss him, Austin reverses it and tosses Gunn out, which this is at least the second Royal Rumble in which Austin has eliminated Gunn, because he eliminated him in 1999 as well.
Steve Austin has it out for Billy Gunn in the Royal Rumble.
Yeah. And who can blame him?
Yeah, I mean, Austin's just like, this isn't going to work, and throws him out every time.
Right, right. Rock hits the DDT on Kane. All three of them are landing on the ground. Austin's bloody, of course. Austin and Rock, then you see them lock eyes and walk to the middle of the ring. They punch at each other. Austin wins the slugfest at first, but Rock gets it back, knocks Austin down, sets up the Rock bottom, but Austin elbows out of it, hits the stunner, then stomps on Rock a bit. Kane grabs Austin from behind, but Austin lands a Fez press. Austin then gets a low blow. Rock and Austin are back at it. Rock hits the Rock bottom. Kane's up and limping after the low blow. Rock tosses Kane, but only through the middle rope. Austin and Rock are both slow to get up. They trade punches and stumble about. Austin lifts him up, but can't get him over the ropes. Rock gets him up, but then Kane comes from behind. He tries to dump them both over, but only Rock ends up going over. Kane then misses a clothesline on Austin. Austin gets a flurry. He tries a running clothesline, but he runs into a Kane choke. Kane hits the choke slam. Then he slashes his throat. He points at Austin. Kane picks him up, and then Austin gets another low blow. Kane goes to the outside. He grabs a chair. Austin kicks his knee. Kane lifts him up, but Austin slides out. He hits the stunner. He grabs the chair. Kane sits up, stands up. Then there are three chair shots to the head by Austin and a running clothesline, which knock Kane over the top and give Austin the win. And by the way, that might be the first time I've ever seen run at the guy on the ropes actually work in a Royal Rumble.
And it worked at the very end.
Yeah.
It worked to give him the win in the match. I know I got really excited with the Austin and Rock stare down. Even watching it again, you know, so many years later, I thought that was a really well done piece of business with the two of them locking eyes from across the ring. The camera work was there. The camera work was really good, and the fans in the arena got it, and they saw what was happening, and their reaction started to swell and swell as both Austin and Rock looked at each other and started to fight, and I thought that was just a really well-put-together sequence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was great. I mean, it was really well, it's really well put together, really exciting, the way that Austin is able to overcome Kane, you know, still making Kane look really formidable, but you know, him managing to accomplish that task. It was more dramatic than you would think, kind of, you know, people, I'm sure at this point, realized that Austin was probably going to win, and, you know, that can certainly feel inevitable, but it didn't feel inevitable. So that's obviously pretty cool.
Yeah, and at one point, Jim Ross says that Austin hit Kane with an XFL-like punt.
Yes.
Which I just thought to myself, did they punt the ball different in the XFL? Really, like, was that, did you need to say that one? Like, not, you know, an XFL like tackle, which I guess was supposed to be more violent and exciting, but just a punt, I guess, was different in the XFL too, which I think proves once again why the XFL did not succeed.
Yeah.
I liked the foreshadowing of Rock and Austin at the end. I really enjoyed. I also have to say that I enjoyed, and maybe I'm reading into it as foreshadowing when it wasn't supposed to be. In fact, I'm 75% sure I am. But Steve Austin using the chair to eliminate Kane reminded me a lot of Steve Austin using the chair to defeat The Rock at WrestleMania 17.
Well, there's a very similar sequence in the Triple H Austin match where Austin sort of does the same thing that he did in The Rock match. So maybe you're onto something. Maybe they were setting that up. Because I'm almost certain that's in the, you know, Triple H match is meant to be an allusion to, you know, foreshadowing for Rock later. So I feel like it's certainly possible here as well.
Yeah, that they, and I think a big part of it was showing the ongoing desperation of Steve Austin. The fact that he doesn't feel like he is what he once was, and he needs to become, you know, he needs this Rumble win to prove that he is. He needs that WrestleMania win to prove that he is, and he'll do whatever it takes to get them, including resorting to using a steel chair,
mm-hmm.
Yep. Which wasn't really painted as a bad guy thing to do in this Rumble. And it kind of brought the ending of the Rumble around to the way the Rumble started with all of the hardcore action.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. It's, you know, it's a good story. And even though I'm not, you know, there are definitely parts of the Steve Austin heel turn that I'm not enamored with, and not, I mean, the performance was great, but as far as that story, I just kind of feel like that was not a, I've warmed up to a little bit over time, but I just kind of feel like the way that story happened, I don't know. I have like an emotional, aversion to it for whatever reason.
I think you kind of go into it knowing that knowing that it's not going to work. And Steve Austin said on Steve Austin's latest WWE Blu-ray release, he did commentary on the WrestleMania 17 match with Jim Ross. And he talks about how he feels it's the best match of his career, how he feels like it was basically perfect. And then he gets into the heel turn at the end, and he says if there's one thing in his career that he wishes he could take back, it's that.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about how how the concept of him turning heel wasn't the problem, that they could have done that, but doing it in Texas, doing it on that high-profile stage, and in a way doing it by him aligning with Vince McMahon was so against everything that the character stood for that no one bought it as real.
Yeah,
that was the moment when the Steve Austin character went from being this real guy that people got behind to a part of a story, and people wanted to believe Austin as more than just a part of a story.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, particularly the alignment with McMahon, but the time and the place, I feel like as well as too. And I think that was even more compounded with the second heel turn at Invasion. Like, I feel like they, you know, they did the thing where they, you know, where Austin
Stone came back.
Yeah, Stone Cold came back and, you know, and he fended off all the Alliance guys by himself. And you have that great visual of the five Team WWF guys being in the middle of the ring and the crowd going insane and Jim Ross screaming about how, you know, it's on for Invasion. And if they just found a way to keep Austin on that side and just have some faith in some of the WCW guys to carry the heel thing or, you know, brought in other guys or whatever. And we don't need to rehash the Invasion again, but I do think that, that was a major thing as well.
Trying to make Austin the lead heel of WCW was weird.
Yes.
There's no other way to put it. It was a really strange move to make him the leader of this group. And then kind of the return to being a babyface at the end of 2001 and the what catchphrase and all that. It was a really strange period in his career, you know, from WrestleMania to about Survivor Series that year. And it's not looked upon favorably. It was a strange time, I think, in Austin's own life, too. It wasn't long before he left the WWE and didn't come back until 2003 for his feud with Eric Bischoff and then eventual feud with The Rock.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah. But this certainly is a, this is, you know, one of Austin's peak moments, his third Royal Rumble win, the only guy to ever do that. So, you know, I wonder if, you know, if you made the Mount Rushmore of the Royal Rumble, if Austin's an automatic to be on there. I mean, I guess three Royal Rumble wins is pretty good. He didn't really do much else at the Rumble besides that because he missed the 2001. I don't think he was at the 96 one, or if he was, he wasn't memorable. But he has the wins at 97, 98, and 2000 was, you know, has at least an interesting story in 99 and was a major part of 2002. So you could make the argument.
Yeah, I think you could, and I almost feel like the three wins, and especially three wins in the era where the Royal Rumble mattered before, you know, when it wasn't just here's the Rumble is the special match. It was here's the Rumble and you get the WrestleMania title shot. Three wins in that era, I think, have to put Austin at the upper echelon of guys who have competed in the Rumble and most likely in the top four.
Yeah, yeah. So one thing that we didn't mention, all that we should real quick, is the ladder match, the Chris Benoit and Chris Jericho ladder match that's on this pay-per-view, which, you know, I would argue is one of the better ladder matches in WWE history, although it's been a long time since I've seen it. But I remember it being really physically brutal and really, you know, like it's more, there's more of a story to it than some of the other ladder matches of that time.
Yeah, ladder matches at this time, this pay-per-view exists in the world between TLC 1 at SummerSlam 2000 and TLC 2 at WrestleMania 17. Mm-hmm. And ladder matches at this time had become stunt shows, most of the time with two to three tag teams in them. And they were exciting and dynamic matches to watch, but at the same time, they didn't tell much of a story. It was, well, Jeff Hardy's going to do this crazy flip, and he's probably going to be down on the floor for about 10 minutes recovering, and maybe he'll get up and do another crazy bump, and then he's going to be down. And it was that kind of match where Benoit and Jericho had a match, I think in a way a lot like the Jericho and Shawn Michaels ladder match at No Mercy 2008, where Benoit and Jericho had a technical, hard-hitting match that involved the ladder.
Right.
It wasn't the Shawn Michaels in 1994 match with a ladder that, you know, people like to say Shawn Michaels had a great match with a ladder and somehow Razor Ramon won. It was a match against each other. They worked in the ladder really well, and it was an impactful, hard-hitting match that I think stands up, you know, against it's 11 years later, and it's still a really entertaining match to watch.
Yeah. Speaking of great Rumble performers, you have Benoit with this, and you have the 2003 Kurt Angle match, and you have the 2004 Royal Rumble win. you know.
That's true. If you open up the Great Rumble performers to not just the match, but the actual just pay-per-view, I think Benoit has to be considered at the top as well, because he had some really great matches and moments in the Rumble. And Rumble, especially that match with Kurt Angle in 2003, exists in such a unique and special vacuum of just a really, really amazing performances.
Yeah, agreed. So anything else that you feel like we should bring up?
I think we got most of the undercard. There was some match involving Lowdown.
They beat Kai and Tai to get a spot in the Royal Rumble, but that eventually went to Drew Carey. And I guess, and I don't really remember this, but there's apparently a funny moment of Vince having to let Lowdown learn the news that they're not going to be involved in the Rumble, and having a apparently it's a fun comedic moment.
I'm sad that I did not watch that.
Yeah, so I'll have to watch it in the future, and we have a listener who is extolling the virtues of that moment. So good times. Oh yeah, the other one was China getting a fake neck injury during the Ivory match, and them using the Owen voice during that.
Oh yeah, that was uncomfortable. Especially, I mean, I'm not a huge fan of calling it the Owen voice, because I think that's kind of unfair. But when they get that serious over a fake neck injury, it's really strange. I don't know. China at this point was such an odd act, because for the first time they tried to put China in the women's division.
Yeah.
Which was really strange. And I think China will come back and beat Ivory in like seconds at WrestleMania 17.
Right.
And it was just this odd decision to, you know, and yeah, China probably should have been in the women's division the entire time. That's, you know, that's another discussion for another day. But to have her in there, you know, to have her in the ring with Ivory was just such a stark contrast. And it's not like Ivory was not muscular and not strong, but China just looks so jacked at this point. China was a frightening spectacle.
Yes. Yes. So, yep. All right. Well, why don't you let everyone know where they can follow you, and of course, your work at prowrestling.net.
Yeah, on the Twitter, you can follow me at It's Will Time. Usually tweeting about wrestling or theater or some other randomness. Sometimes you see cute pictures of my dog, which is pretty great because she's awesome. But yeah, that most of the time, the tweeting is about wrestling, though, much to the chagrin of anyone that actually knows me in real life and not the interweb. Also, you can head on over to prowrestling.net for your wrestling news needs, your wrestling analysis needs. I think with myself, I'm obviously very proud of my work there, but different voices. There's five of us that regularly write for the site as far as analysis goes, and none of us really agree about wrestling. We all want something different. We all look for something different, and while we may agree at times, I think for wrestling commentary, it's one of the most diverse outlooks you can get on it, where I don't think any of us are your online stereotype where we think everything sucks until it's 2 years after and then it doesn't suck anymore. We really try hard to buck stereotypes and to just say what we like about wrestling.
All right. Well, thanks again for being on the show. Everyone, of course, check out prowrestling.net. And again, also, please check out our sponsors, RotoReels.com for wrestling downloads and DVDs, and InternationalObject.com for thoughtful essays and podcasts into the events and issues of professional wrestling. So thanks everyone for listening. Of course, check us out at WrestleSpective.com for all of our podcasts and to subscribe to the podcast, and check us out on Twitter and Facebook as well. So everyone, thanks for listening, and we'll be back again soon.